National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, Judith Ross with Shirley Stolzer, interviewing for the fifth interview with Gertrude F. Kaplan. Gertrude, again, would you please state your name and address for clarification on the machine?
Thank you. Indeed, I will. I'm Gertrude Kaplan, and I have enjoyed being interviewed by Shirley and Judy, and I trust this is indeed the fifth and last interview.
This is April 29, 1992. Gertrude, we ended up and did not complete with the last interview. You had just begun to tell us some of the differences, in your opinion, between medical practices when your husband, and the medical, shall we say, ambiance, when your husband began to practice, and current day medical practice here in Pittsburgh. You particularly mentioned the place of the practicing physician, and particularly relating to Montefiore, and also the current day, shall we say, lack of Jewishness. You had just begun to comment on those issues.
I'm almost embarrassed. Thank you for reminding me, Judy. I'm almost embarrassed because I'm hardly an authority on this subject. Indeed, I've been attached to a hospital by virtue of my volunteer activities and exposed to the scene on that level, and of course married to a practicing internist in the city for over 50 years. I've been exposed, so I don't set myself up as an authority on this. But there's no question that some of the very strong changes have become patently clear to me, and if I refer to them, it's as a lay person, obviously. The role of the clinician in medicine early on, 40, 50 years ago, the attending physician, not the full-time academic, not the full-time on-staff person, was more significant in the practice of medicine, I think. People had a very, it seems to me, much stronger one-to-one relationship with their family physician. Case in point, they had no reluctance, and then the expectation was normal that he would come to the house and he would see them, he or she, and there weren't that many she's then. The major advances in medicine in the last few decades that we all recognize, and as Paul has said to me, in the last 25 years, the advances surpass everything that had been known in the field in the entire history of medicine before. So that technically changed a great deal. The patient began to, and I see this to this day, it just shocks me, intelligent people who you think would know better, who do indeed use, let's say, an internist or a diagnostician as their primary physician. Those individuals still, today, will determine what their needs are when they have a problem and go directly to a specialist without getting the professional direction, without getting the diagnosis, if you will. They are so attuned now that there is a specialty, a specialist for every problem, that they don't even expect the original physician to direct them in their course. They don't expect, and if I dare personalize, my husband's office is a case in point. I have comparative strangers come up to me and say, your husband's office, they're incredible. They still come to the house when we need them. And this includes some of the younger physicians in the office. Now, the other thing that is very apparent, and it's apparent to be specific in terms of the Montefiore University Hospital now, is that though we had hoped when the hospital was purchased, we on the outside looking in, though I'm not so outside, I sit in on many meetings and I know what goes on staff. But nevertheless, parenthetically, we see that really the full-time physicians and their own internal staff people are becoming more and more the dominant staff. As a result of which, the Jewish physicians today in the city are everywhere. And we just had an interesting conversation, since this is meant to be historically significant, I'll make this comment. We were with a physician who could not get operating, a neurosurgeon, who could not get operating time at Montefiore when he applied for it. And it was ironic because he was Jewish. And there was an internal political confrontation, and he left Montefiore totally, which was also ironic because his stepbrother was the president of the board at one point. And he became a became the most active neurosurgeon at Allegheny General Hospital. Now, we know that Allegheny General Hospital is a tremendous institution with a tremendous impact in our city, and a very successful institution. But it was notoriously not the place where Jewish physicians practiced. And now, there were two or three. We could count literally on one hand the men, and we knew them who were there. And one was the full-time physician who ran the Singer Laboratory, Dr. Robert Grauer. He was the first and at one point the only Jewish physician, I believe, at Allegheny General. Then two or three others came on, and they have a few. Now, interestingly enough, a rather conservative Orthodox psychiatrist, whom we know very well, whom Paul has used in consultation, came up to us at a social event recently to tell us that he was going to, that he had been courted by and was going to work primarily at Allegheny General Hospital. Mm-hmm. So we see this happening all over the city. West Penn was another case in point. Though they had Jewish physicians early on, they didn't have the numbers of them. I hear people saying now that when they go to Shadyside and West Penn Hospital, they think they're walking through old Montefiore. Mm-hmm. So many Jewish staff people and so many Jewish patients. Mm-hmm. Now, to get back to Allegheny General, they were talking with this neurosurgeon, they being president, chiefs of staff, people in key positions. How can we attract the Jewish patient? I said, this is incredible. I said, we're such a small percentage of the population. What is this that they're concerned? He said, they are concerned. This is a segment of the community they want. How do they get them there? Well, we said, the obvious way to get them there is to start with your Jewish physicians. But that's no longer so cogent, because your Jewish physicians today are everywhere, and the Jewish physicians don't necessarily have all the Jewish patients. It's a very interesting, and I think a rather significant point he makes here. It's just probably a microcosm of the many changes in the marketing of medicine today. I think that this is, of course, what has occurred. Hospitals are doing such enormous marketing. The old-time physician who was ethical and felt that people chose him primarily, exclusively, on the basis of his capabilities, his expertise, and his reputation, you begin to wonder to what extent that still happens. So it's a really very changing scene. I don't know if I've totally addressed your question, but I think maybe I have.
Yes, you definitely have.
Well, I just really wondered in terms, I thought Judy was asking, when your husband went into practice,
mm-hmm.
what kind of scene was then
mm-hmm.
as contrasted with now?
Mm-hmm.
Because you say, for example, that his office is still making home visits. That was a very common thing.
Absolutely.
I know when my children were young, when I was young.
Sure,
you know, doctor
sure.
always came to the house.
The pediatrician, the general practitioner, uh-huh. the internist even. Right.
Was there as much, for example, competition among the hospitals for doctors, for Jewish doctors' services, that kind of
oh,
thing?
Oh, well.
What was it like?
Well, I think we, if that's an aspect of it, I think we can definitely say that there was no question when he was ready to intern that only one place was going to take him, and that was Montefiore. Now, I am going back. He interned in 1936. So we're talking over 50 years here, 55
right.
years. And, I mean, he was part of the quota system. It was unique that he got into medical school after only 2 years of pre-med, which made him a doctor at 22. He was out of medical school and in an internship at 22. I didn't know Paul then. It's interesting. We talk about this because our eldest grandson, whether I dare allude to this or not, who is a junior at Harvard, has determined that he's going into medicine. His father and his grandfather both are in medicine, but neither of them felt they used any overt influence on him. It could have been subliminal.
Mm-hmm.
He's strong In fact, I'll digress for a moment. He's strong in physics, biochemistry, nuclear biology, molecular biology. And he just called us the other day to say he got a job in Boston this summer. He spent his birthday in April taking his MedCADs. That was a day he won't forget. And he wanted a job in Boston, and he did get it, and he's going to work on the eon transfers in renal disease, whatever that means, so we know what renal disease is. But the point I want to make is that this kind of variety of opportunity didn't exist for Paul and Paul's generation. It didn't occur to him to apply to medical school anywhere but Pitt, because he felt he had probably the best chance of getting in there in the quota system. Mm-hmm. And there were six Jews. Mm-hmm. And he did train. He did do his resident work at Beth Israel in Boston. That he knew to do. I didn't know him then. I met Paul when he was already through with all of his formal professional training, and when he was already in the practice of medicine, in internal medicine. They're just such dramatic changes. The other interesting thing when we talk about this is that there aren't as many applicants now for medicine, as you well know. Hmm. I mean, I heard a shocking statistic that it's only 1.5 applicants per available space. The cost of a medical career is so staggering. The complexity of the field is so overwhelming. The enormity of the learning process, that apparently fewer young people are going into it. And then of course, the enormous influence of government today on this. I mean, this has to be alluded to. This isn't just you practice and you bill a patient and you get paid, or you don't get paid. And I might say that when Paul was in practice, his first office was in the West End. And even as advanced as he thought his practice was, he used the barter system. I mean, he'd get chicken and eggs instead of payment sometimes. One of the wonderful things we once got, if I may digress again, was a young man who's become a nationally renowned painter out of Pittsburgh, George Nama by name, N-A-M-A. George's mother was a patient, and I'll never forget that Paul came home one day and said, Mr. Nama wants to come over with some paintings. His mother can't pay his bill. Can he give us a painting or two? And I said, well, that sounds lovely. I'd be delighted. And we have a very large, wonderful painting by Nama, which was payment for his mother's care. Yeah.
I think it's interesting you mention the enormous influence of government in terms of fees, in terms of who can go into the hospital and who can't be hospitalized.
So controlled.
Which I think it has evidently influenced a lot of fellows who want to be free to practice and to make the final decision as to who goes in and should they be there.
And how long should they be there and when they come out. Mm-hmm. It's a very, it's a much more complicated profession.
Right.
The changes are revolutionary. They really are. I think of all the professions, when you think of law and you think of pharmacy and you think of accounting and business, the most dramatic changes have occurred, it seems to me, in medicine. On those two levels, the amount of government intervention, the amount of control, and the amount of knowledge and the scientific advancements. Mm-hmm. I haven't been asked to analyze this before, but it seems to me it comes down to this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Those are very, and I was well aware of where you're coming from in terms of your observations, but that's exactly what
you were inquiring about.
Yes, I wasn't.
By the way, even the term internal medicine
has so changed.
Back, I don't remember doctors being internists. They were physicians.
Well, the whole
until you got
subspecialty.
Yes,
the whole subspecialty. Now that though was Well, as a matter of fact, we can talk personally about this, Shirley. When we went to our first arthritis and rheumatic disease convention, ARA, the American Rheumatism Association meetings, there were maybe 200 in the country who were practicing rheumatology. Now, when we go to any of those meetings, there are thousands, thousands.
Right.
I mean, this was an early subspecialty then.
Right.
And I'm not even so sure. Now, Paul, of course, him as a fellow of the American College of Physicians very early, studied for it, took writtens, took orals, went through the whole process. But I'm not so sure there was even a subspecialty examination at the time early on. There wasn't.
Right.
So that's part of the whole massive cyclical change we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there were probably more general practitioners
when
your husband started than subspecialties.
As an internist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Although there seems to be a trend.
Family practice and
yes.
family art.
Yes.
There, that's a good point.
Return.
But they even trained for that.
Yes.
Yes.
And to St. Margaret's. And Paul was really in the executive. He was a member of the board. I may have mentioned this to you in one of our previous interviews, that he was the first doctor and the only Jew elected to the board, of St. Margaret's, not by virtue of being president of the staff at one point, but by virtue of his own status. And he served in a vice presidential capacity for many years. He was on the board for at least 13, 14 years. And they wanted him even to stay on beyond that, and he felt no, rotation was important, and he did. But during that period, this whole family practice residency, which is very strong there, was in its infancy and took hold. And it's a very good program.
Mm-hmm.
I think Robert Wood Johnson Foundation may have been a part of that.
When was that? Do you remember?
Oh, dear.
Approximately?
I'd say at least 20, 25 years ago. You know, we lose track of time. I'm not sure that that's absolutely accurate, but it seems to me it might be 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Shirley, did you have any other
Not
comments?
Not.
Oh, okay. That's moving on to a different area, but again, and I mentioned in our last interview about looking back and with an eye towards the future, you have, in your years here in Pittsburgh, lived in numerous different neighborhoods.
Yes, well, I grew up in Oakland.
Okay.
And
the line of my question
yeah.
is, along the lines of changes
uh-huh.
and or reminiscences,
uh-huh.
Could you relate some of that to us? The different changes in the neighborhoods, you have come back to Oakland.
The pendulum swings full
right,
cycle.
And there are some obvious changes, I'm sure, both for the positive and negative.
Well,
I
always loved Oakland. I loved the proximity, and I was never conscious of it going to school all through the years. And going to the library, and going to the playhouse, and going to the Y Playhouse for rehearsals. I mean, this was my area. Though I traveled to Squirrel Hill for much of my social existence, and I traveled to town for my education extracurricular, my elocution lessons, my dance lessons, my rehearsals as a child, were downtown. And I think maybe I told you that I was perfectly safe and comfortable going on buses and streetcars from the time I was probably 8, 9 years old, by myself. I always traveled by public transportation. And there was no fear on my parents' part or my part. So that's certainly a vital sociological change.
Yes.
The neighborhoods. When we came back to Pittsburgh after Paul was released from the service, and we had our first child, we lived very briefly in East End. We rented a house on North Sheridan Avenue. Because housing was impossible. We weren't sure whether we were staying in Pittsburgh. Paul thought he might go back to Boston for some additional work in a subspecialty, and our transitional period was such that we didn't want to buy immediately. So we rented. Had a very unpleasant experience with the owner of the house, who said that he was definitely not going to put it up for sale, and 6 months after we moved in, and he did a great deal to it to put it in living order for us and had our first baby, he did put it up for sale. I did not like living in East End. I wasn't used to, I didn't have my own car, I wasn't used to traveling that distance to get to Oakland or Squirrel Hill, and I found it cumbersome. We loved living in Squirrel Hill, and I do think the interesting thing about Pittsburgh, the uniqueness of our city, is the stability of Squirrel Hill, still primarily the center of Jewish life. People have had the misimpression that that in percentages, Squirrel Hill had the majority of Jews. Even when I'm talking about it, and I taught at Auderdice, I know this, we never were quite 50% of the population. We might have been 40, 45% of the population. Mm-hmm. And over the years, the diversity in Squirrel Hill, the multi-ethnicity was so apparent mm-hmm. and so healthy. It's such a unique inner city community, but it is diverse in race, in religion, in ethnicity, as you well know. But the stability of the Jewish community continues to be there. Now, I've seen, and I've seen so much in my communal life, of the spreading out of the Jewish population. South Hills is a case in point. When I was the chair, I think of this, of the Women's Division Campaign for Federation, and this was in the 60s, I chaired the campaign. It was very difficult to get Jewish women out in the South Hills to feel or to care about Federation and the services it rendered. There was a very lovely doctor's wife, they'd moved, what's his name? He was affiliated with the university, was a neurosurgeon. Rosimoff, Dr. Hubert Rosimoff and his wife, did you know them? Well, she was lovely and came from a background of community in Philadelphia and New York. And she became my chairperson for South Hills for a division. We worked very hard to get the women out. And that's been an ongoing struggle, though there's much more involvement now.
Was that with Ladies Hospital Aid?
No, that was with Federation. Federation. Now, we could never, Hospital Aid could never make much of an impression there. There are some members, but it was never a significant number. Now, today, we look at Fox Chapel. Do you realize how many young Jewish people, yuppies, and affluent society. Now, 25, 30 years ago, they weren't welcome in Fox Chapel. Mm-hmm. We must make this point. They weren't wanted there, and they weren't sold to there. But I can even allude to the fact that in Squirrel Hill, when Paul and I went looking for a house, a big house, in the 50s, there were houses on Beechwood Boulevard that were still participating in a gentleman's agreement. Mm-hmm. And I could specifically name the family, Fisher. S. Aiken Fisher from Fisher Scientific had his house on the market. And when I said something to my realtor about, can I look at that house, was the size, was the location, she kind of hemmed and hawed. And I said, now what is the hesitancy? And she told me she wasn't sure he wanted to sell to a Jew. I said, then I don't want to look at it. I won't give him the satisfaction of even looking at it. But you know what? He sold to Jews because that was the picture and the pattern. Well, be that as it may, we sent our girls to public school. Mm-hmm. We talk about sociological changes. We weren't threatened or disturbed by, we were pre-integration and I guess that whole picture. We felt they got a very good education at Colfax, Whiteman, then Colfax, then Alderdice. Though our younger daughter did go away to school by virtue of her dance specialty. So, as I may have mentioned, she went to the North Carolina School of the Arts. Did I mention that?
No. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that's fascinating because she was the only Jewess. She was the first Pennsylvanian and the only Jewess at North Carolina School of the Arts. And her roommate, who came from a very little small town in North Carolina, by the way, that's in Winston-Salem. Mm. And her roommate looked at her and Robbie said, what are you looking at? She was looking for the horns that she thought Jews mm-hmm. had. And her first Christmas, I'll never forget Robbie calling and saying, Mom, Daddy, send me a menorah. Bring me a menorah. I'm Christmas to death. Mm-hmm. So they called her the rabbi. Mm-hmm. And she brought her knowledge of religion and Judaism, and it really made more impact to her there. But again, in terms of neighborhoods, Oakland, of course, has become more and more. It was always the Civic Educational Medical Center. But it has become more and more so, and we see that. It's also become so much more the multiple housing section of the city, of the inner city. with luxury apartments and middle class apartments. And it's interesting the impact of the older citizen on our lives, on our cultural community, our educational. I think Pitt's informal program's a case in point. They're amazed at the success of their programs from senior citizens. The Carnegie, the lecture series, all the cultural activities. And this is both a healthy sign and both a worrisome sign. Mm-hmm. We happened to be with Pittsburgh Symphony friends Sunday night for a retirement party of one of the administrative staff. And we know that they're losing regular subscriptions despite all of their marketing and all of their diversity of programming and all of their everything. It's getting harder and harder to get the younger generation to buy season tickets. There was this nucleus always in Pittsburgh, and very much of this nucleus was the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. The Jewish community has been manifest and evident in cultural strength in Pittsburgh far beyond our numbers. I think we recognize this.
Yeah.
I know that when I look at my work with Three Rivers Shakespeare Festival, the amount of support we get from the Squirrel Hill community, the Shadyside community, the Oakland community, and among those numbers of Jews is considerable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is why the whole picture of volunteerism and involvement in our city is so much in transition also, because Jews are welcome now in cultural activities where there was much reluctance to put them on boards.
Mm-hmm.
They're still in limited numbers, they're still tokenism, but if you indicate, and this is true in symphony, this is true in ballet, this is true in theater, if you indicate your willingness to work as well as your willingness to give, there's more open sesame today. As a result of which, and there's also recognition quickly. In our volunteer work in the Jewish spectrum, we didn't do it so much for recognition. We didn't do it because of the quid pro quo. It was a matter of feeling that it was important that we give and take care. This was tzedakah in the original sense, in the original concept. It's different today. We see this among our young Jewish people. They count their hours of work, where it is, and how it will, there's really a little more selfishness in it, I think. Again, I'm generalizing. And again, there are exceptions. But we do see this across the board.
Mm-hmm.
We see how difficult it is, especially in the 30 to 50 age group, to get those men and women to care.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you in that, because I think that's interesting what you said in terms of young people. And it occurs to me that when your children grew up and my children grew up,
mm-hmm.
they saw their mothers and their fathers doing volunteer work, mm-hmm. so they had examples,
role models.
Mm-hmm. Now they see both parents working. They don't have time to do other things.
That's right.
My question is, so what happens in terms of the future of volunteer work?
Yes. Well, because I've seen it myself. I'll give myself, because this is really what you want to know, as an example. When I went into the presidency of Ladies Hospital Aid with a 4,000 membership, there wasn't one paid employee, not one. And as our organization grew so large and larger and our activities so much more extensive, we saw the need for at least a part-time secretary. And it was in my presidency that we hired a part-time secretary. Now, there isn't an organization today, women's organization or men's, that doesn't have more professional paid help. Because more and more is done. Now there's continuity given by the paid person. I mean, professional leadership comes and goes and is in transition all the time, though I guess I'm unique in that. Here I am going back on the Chronicle board and taking the chairmanship of long-range planning after all this time. I'd been on it many years ago, and they asked me to please come back, take this position. All right. I'm not so sure I'm the usual example of my age and my generation being recycled. Though organizations do reach out to old leadership. They see the balance. They need it. And it's an interesting thing. We had a retreat last year for Federation, for the board. And I was the second eldest person there. Thank God for Herman Feinberg. He was there older than I. And Herman and I were in a buzz session, a sub-workshop group together, and we had the youngest people with us there. We both loved it. And I started, and Herman started on some historical things, and we apologized, and we stopped, and we said to these young people, we don't want to bore you. And they both said, you're not boring us. You're telling us what we need to know. We want to know these things. We don't know the history of some of these agencies. We don't know what happened before Federation merged with the fund. We don't know what happened when you were a part of Community Chest. We don't know when the hospital left United Way. So the balance, I think, of the older, more seasoned leadership and the newer leadership is healthy and good. And I must say Federation does try. But then what happens is there's not room for all these young people to come in. And you must make room for them on your boards and in your chairmanships and in your activities. When the chips are down, though, it's some of us who are old leadership who do a lot of the campaigning, mm-hmm. who clean up the cards, who go to the telephones, who take, I got cards yesterday at a board meeting. These haven't been done, Gert. Will you see that these people? Now I get a letter, please join us again for the follow-up of the Exodus campaign. Key leadership is meeting. We need you to come. So there is this balance.
But don't you wonder how young people react to this? Because when it comes down to basics,
yeah.
they turn to the people who have been there year after year after year.
Not really, Shirley. No? Not really. I do see. I'm sorry for the telephone interruption.
That's all right.